Poverty and Corruption, the HDP and its allies will not nominate a candidate for May 14.
The announcement is considered a major setback for Turkish President Erdogan, as the HDP is the third largest party in parliament. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan slammed the opposition bloc's cooperation with the pro-PKK People's Democratic Party, saying alliances should focus on common principles rather than negotiations over seats.
The announcement by the Kurdish alliance that they will not nominate a candidate will make this election difficult for President Erdogan, which means that the Kurdish votes will go to Kılıçdaroğlu. Yesterday, we also heard President Erdogan say that 17 of his ministers and his deputy will run for parliamentary elections to strengthen his party's position in these elections. Erdogan knows his position is not the strongest after the Kurdish alliance announcement and is trying to fix things around him to make sure he wins.
On Tuesday, the day before the announcement, Kılıçdaroğlu met with HDP leadership in the parliament building in Ankara, during which he made promises to remove restrictions on the Kurdish language and address other related issues. The May 14 election looks to be a tough one for the ruling party and its allies. Many say Kurdish voters could play the role of a kingmaker and help the opposition win this time. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
The United Nations headquarters in Geneva once again played host to the annual Human Rights Council session on Monday, where the UN Special Rapporteur to Iran released a report on women's rights situation inside the Islamic Republic. Predictably, his views sparked major disputes with Iran's delegation over accusations of mistreatment of women in recent months following Western-backed anti-Iran riots.
Advocacy for human rights is increasingly mistaken by some states and human rights mandate holders for their unwarranted and egotistic purposes, abusing the human rights mechanisms to single out and target those nations with independent foreign policy is void of any added value for protection of human rights.
As the envoys battled it out, two Iranian onlookers had a very real story of abuse, which had been largely ignored until now. Manager Safiyari and Elham Jalizavi, two Iranian nationals who suffered horrifically following terrorist attacks on Iranian soil. The culprits, notorious anti-Iran terrorist group the MKO, an obscure cult organization which currently receives significant Western support and even maintains a presence at the UN itself via NGOs.
By providing them asylum, Western countries violated the 1951 convention, enabling them to carry on all their human rights violations, which has in turn led to our rights being violated.
Safiyari was left wheelchair-bound at 17 after an MKO bomb attack targeted a market in 1985. Jalizavi was just 15 when her father was killed in their home by an MKO mortar attack in 1991. These are just two examples of the countless Iranian victims of MKO aggression. With the help of a sympathetic non-governmental organization, the Association for Defending Victims of Terrorism, their calls for justice have now reached the heart of the UN.
The MKO are a cult who commit these acts. Their members have been duped into cooperating with them. They've also been brainwashed. Their families, too, have suffered as a result. They, too, have fallen victim to the MKO.
They should be tried in court, not allowed to come here and claim innocence. We have even filed a lawsuit with French courts because many members live in France, but unfortunately the courts voted in their favour.
Despite past recognition of the MKO as terrorist organisation in the Western world, the US and its allies have performed a U-turn, now promoting them as legitimate opposition to the Islamic Republic, despite their many crimes against Iranian civilians.
The relationship between the Islamic Republic and the United Nations have gone through strained times, but it seems as if the UN is seemingly happy to continue providing a platform for anti-Iran terrorist organizations such as this. And as long as they do, it'll be hard to believe that ordinary Iranians will ever be able to fully trust this international institution. Robert Carter, Geneva.
Destination following his re-election.
This is in line with historical logic because we are each other's largest neighboring powers. We are also all-round strategic partners.
This is the 40th meeting between Putin and Xi during their presidency, which indicates the high and close level of cooperation between China and Russia for a long time. President Xi arrived in Moscow on March 24, for a three-day visit. He began his visit with an informal meeting with Vladimir Putin, which lasted almost 5 hours. On Tuesday, the head of state held an official meeting at the Grand Kremlin Palace. The priority in relations between Russia and China is trade and economic cooperation. In the documents signed by the two leaders, they vowed to multiply the volume of trade. It is expected that the Russian Federation and China will exceed the historical record trade volume of $200 billion this year. On February 24th, on the anniversary of the start of the Russian military operation in Ukraine, the Chinese Foreign Ministry presented a 12-point plan to resolve the conflict in Ukraine.
We believe that many of the provisions of the peace plan put forward by China are consonant with Russian approaches and can be taken as the basis for a peaceful settlement when they are ready for it in the West and in Kiev. However, so far we have not observed such readiness on their part.
China and Russia, as permanent members of the UN Security Council, also vowed to uphold the fundamental norms of international relations and build up constructive force for the formation of a multipolar world.
As for sending military equipment and weapons, military cooperation, China is unlikely to take drastic steps. First of all, China acts based on its own interests, not forgetting that relations with the Western world do not become bad. Otherwise, China itself faces sanctions. Its main trading partners are still in the West.
Putin and Xi Jinping also signed two joint documents setting long-term goals until 2030 across all tracks, a statement on plans for economic cooperation and a statement on plans to deepen partnership.
The Chinese president's three-day visit to Russia demonstrates the close historical relations between Beijing and Moscow. Any agreement made during Xi's trip can be regarded as a milestone given the fact that a new world order is being shaped. Марина Картунова, Moscow.
Black community leaders demanding immediate action to reform Britain's largest police force, coinciding with an official report into the Metropolitan Police by victims' rights and social welfare expert. It was exactly that failure that prompted the report. In March 2021, Wayne Cousins, a serving Metropolitan Police officer, abducted, tortured, raped, and killed Sarah Everard. Cousins was jailed for life. His conviction prompted another woman to come forward, accusing another officer, David Carrick, convicted of raping 12 victims over 17 years. Police Commissioner Mark Rowley has welcomed the report, but stopped short of admitting the force he leads is institutionally racist.
We have racist, misogynist, and homophobes in the organization, and it's not just about individuals. We have systemic failings, management failings, and cultural failings. The reason, and I respect Louise using that term, the reason I don't use it, I think it's a very ambiguous term.
On the whole, the report is condemning of this big organization, pointing to the fact that it has lost public confidence and consent, and that it has to wake up, own up to the problems plaguing it, and engage in wholesale across-the-board reforms.
Black community leaders, though, say they're concerned the reform may not go far enough.
This is just another report saying the same thing that's been said for decades now in this here country. The Metropolitan Police is institutionally racist. Policing is harmful. It's misogynistic. It is homophobic. And for me, as a black woman, the police, the Met Police, is an anti-black organization, anti-black racism organization.
In February, the charity inquest found that black people are 7 times more likely than white people.
Black people are 5 times more likely to be tasered than white people. You could go on and on and on.
The report is a wake-up call for the Metropolitan Police. Its author, as do these minority community leaders, says her recommendations are not to be picked from, but to be implemented. Without them, she says, the force may need to be disbanded. Saipur is up, London.
The On Monday, head of Iran's Strategic Council on Foreign Relations, Kamal Karazi, met Syria's Foreign Minister Faisal al-Maqdad in Damascus and discussed regional and international developments, renewing Tehran's support for the Syrian people, army and government. Karazi then delivered a lecture at Al-Assad Library. He said the Ukrainian conflict will lead to a new world order. He noted that the U.S. and its allies failed in their campaign to defeat Syria, asserting their intervention killed millions of people and spread extremism. Karazi said the West was willing to reconcile with President Assad if Syria had cut relations with Iran, hailing the joint policy of resistance between Damascus and Tehran.
The power of a country is expressed by its capabilities and steadfastness against pressures. This fact has been interpreted by the policy of resistance adopted by Iran and Syria across half of a century. This sparked hostilities from Israel and the West. The joint Syrian-Iranian experience proves that the main factor behind power is being able to resist international hegemony and confront arrogant world powers' greedy policies.
It's difficult today to find a state that shares similar policies with Syria. The common point that brings Syria and Iran together is supporting Palestine. Syria and Iran almost share identical viewpoints in all subjects.
Karazi clarified that the Iranian diplomacy is aimed at enhancing Iran's national security and defense capabilities. He stressed that Iran did not make the mistake made by regional countries of being reliant in their security on others. On the recent Iranian-Saudi talks, Karazi stressed that dialogue is capable of solving all problems without any foreign intervention.
Iran considers Saudi Arabia a big and influential country in the Islamic world. None of the two states should ignore the other. Both the states should use their capabilities to enhance regional security. Adopting cooperation and increasing dialogue instead of confrontation will end all crises without any foreign intervention.
The top official called for the withdrawal of illegal foreign troops from Syria. He expressed Iran's support to forming a strong government in Lebanon. He asserted that Israel's main goal is to destabilize the region, affirming Iran will continue to confront such efforts.
Iran's foreign policy has been a key boon to creation of balanced strategies to deal with regional challenges based on dialogue. Karazi reiterated during his visit that Syrian-Iranian relations have set an example of a successful alliance and resistance against U.S. and Western hegemony. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Sound the flute, now it's mute. Merry, merrily, merrily to welcome in the year. Those were the words of William Blake, but Iranian peoples have been literally doing so more than 3,000 years prior to that 18th century poem, welcoming spring with Nowruz celebrations.
Nowruz is an ancient tradition. It literally means new day, and this is how we celebrate our new year, which begins on the first day of spring and usually falls on March 21st. Nowruz and the arrival of spring remind us that it is time for new beginnings and leaving behind our sorrows.
While many people start their new year holidays a couple of days before Nowruz, the streets are jammed with last-minute shoppers. After all, no matter what the circumstances, you can't have a Nowruz without a half-seen table.
I personally prefer shopping for the half-seen table just a few hours before Nowruz. It's both fun and games. Aside from the Nowruz shopping that I enjoy, I also love the hustle and bustle and the festive New Year's mood in the streets.
Iranians have their own special way of welcoming spring, and one of the most prominent of these traditions is setting the half-seen table, an arrangement of seven symbolic items that start with the sound S in Farsi, representing regrowth, health, and prosperity.
There are also other things we do to welcome spring, including a major spring cleaning of our homes, shopping for new clothes, and most importantly, visiting one another, short visits that are usually reciprocated.
The Nowruz festive events culminate in Sizdebedar, the 13th day of the new year, which is also the last day of the Nowruz holidays. It is traditionally spent outdoors, picnicking and playing games. The holiday is also referred to as Nature Day.
Happy Nowruz, or as Iranians would say, we wish you 1,000 years better than this year. Gisumi Shahmadi, Tehran.
Afghanistan has been celebrating Nowruz, the Persian New Year, for centuries. It is usually a colorful and joyous festival, welcoming spring and a new life. But the celebration has been dampened since the Taliban's takeover in 2021 and the subsequent economic hardships. Nowruz is no longer an official holiday in Afghanistan. However, the Taliban authorities say they won't prevent people from celebrating the festival.
Our country needs working days rather than a lot of holidays. Nowruz won't be celebrated by the Islamic Emirate, nor is it an official holiday. But we won't stop people from what they do on this day either. However, we will instruct them to act by Islamic law and our values.
Despite challenges, many Afghans are determined to keep their spirits high and enjoy the Nowruz festivities. They dress up in new clothes and visit their relatives and friends. Afghan families also prepare special dishes such as hafsin, samanak, and fish. Many others plant trees and flowers to signify growth and prosperity. All in all, Afghans hope for a better year ahead, one that brings peace and joy to their war-torn country.
Nowruz is our ancestral tradition. It has been passed down to us from generation to generation. Nowruz means a new beginning, and its message is that we should let go of the past and begin a new year with new resolutions.
Nowruz brings us joy and blessing. It's reflecting the rebirth of nature and renewal of sprites. I hope God blesses this year with peace and prosperity. We look forward to witnessing the end of instability and chaos in our country.
Afghan people say they still find joy and meaning in their traditions and culture. For them, Nowruz is more than just a festival. It's a way of life that celebrates your heritage and resilience. Nowruz is a time of joy and the promise of good days to come. Wishing you a happy and prosperous new year. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون.
تلاوت القرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones. But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran, Quran.
In the limelight.
American economists warned against the expansion of the scope of the banking crisis in America and the bankruptcy of more banks in this country. A study by a group of economists showed that at least 186 American banks are at risk of collapse, similar to Silicon Valley Bank. The economic crisis of the West, which started in 2008 and is the result of America's problems, has worsened with the conflict between Russia and NATO in Ukraine. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world media press and news agencies to shed more light on the issue. Please stay tuned. RT reports, according to a new study, dozens of banks in the United States are on the verge of collapse, despite the Biden administration's recent measures to calm the turbulent markets. The study conducted by four economists said nearly 200 American banks face similar risks to those that led to the implosion and bankruptcy of Silicon Valley Bank, SVB. SVB, a major U.S. bank focused on lending capital to the tech and startup sectors, was shut down by regulators recently after massive deposits outflows, as known as bank run. This study estimated how much market value the assets held by U.S. banks had lost due to higher interest rates. This study, by the four economists who hailed from prominent U.S. universities, which was posted recently to the Social Science Research Network, stated, from March 7, 2022 to March 6, 2023, the federal funds rate rose sharply from 0.8% to 4.57%, and this increase was accompanied by quantitative tightening. As a result, long-dated assets similar to those held on bank balance sheets experienced significant value declines during the same period. On one hand, higher interest rates can benefit banks by allowing them to lend at a higher rate. On the other hand, many U.S. banks have parked a significant portion of their excess cash in U.S. treasuries. This was done when interest rates were at near zero levels. The value of these bonds has now greatly decreased due to the rate hikes. Investors can now simply purchase newly issued bonds that offer a higher interest rate. The decline in the bank's portfolios is unrealized, meaning the value of the securities has declined, but the losses are still only on paper. For banks, the problem starts when customers request their deposits back and are forced to sell their securities at a significant loss. In order to pay depositors back, this can lead in extreme cases to a bank becoming insolvent. Or, as happened with SVB, the loss of confidence can trigger a bank run. The authors of the report looked into how the amount of U.S. lenders' funding that comes from uninsured deposits, the greater the share, the more susceptible a bank is to a run. For example, at SVB, where 92.5% of deposits were uninsured, the deposit outflow caused the bank to collapse in a span of only 2 days. The study's authors calculated that 186 American banks do not have enough assets to pay all customers. If even half of the uninsured depositors decide to withdraw their money. The Economist concluded our calculations suggest these banks are certainly at potential risk of a run, absent other government intervention or recapitalization. Overall, these calculations suggest that recent declines in bank asset values very significantly increased the fragility of the U.S. banking system to uninsured depositor runs, noting that the number of banks at risk could be significantly larger if uninsured deposit withdrawals cause even small fire sales. Meanwhile, the Cointelegraph.com writes, Silicon Valley Bank's collapse caused jitters across the U.S. and global financial institutions in grip of contagion fears. Many of these institutions have seen their stocks plunge, with the six largest Wall Street banks losing around $165 billion in market capitalization so far. Moody's Credit Ratings has downgraded its outlook for the U.S. banking system from stable to negative, citing the rapidly deteriorating operating environment. Turmoil at Credit Suisse, the Swiss bank, has added to jitters among investors. However, U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has defended the Biden administration's response to the SVB fallout amid fears of broader contagion. During a recent Finance Committee hearing, Yellen claimed that the U.S. banking system was sound. However, lawmakers on the Senate Finance Committee grilled Yellen, questioning the recent aggressive intervention by U.S. regulators and officials to guarantee all deposits at the collapsed SVB and Signature Bank and set up a new Federal Reserve facility to provide liquidity to other banks. Yellen insisted, I can reassure the members of the committee that our banking system is sound and that Americans can feel confident that their deposits will be there when they need them, claiming recent actions demonstrate our resolute commitment to ensure that our national system remains strong and depositor savings remain safe. Lawmakers went on to repeatedly press Yellen to say what had caused the trouble at SVB. She answered there was a run on the bank, adding that there was a massive withdrawal of deposits that led to liquidity problems. Yellen continued by saying that her understanding of the reason for the collapse was that SVB had to sell assets that it expected to hold to maturity, but they had lost market value in light of the recent interest rate increases. Furthermore, the Newsweek reports, according to Robert Kiyosaki, co-author of the best-selling book Rich Dad, Poor Old, Swiss banking giant Credit Suisse will be the next to go bust. Kiyosaki, who forecast Lehman Brothers' collapse and predicted in November that the U.S. stock exchange was headed for a giant crash, reiterated his forecast for U.S. financial markets collapse. He said, the problem is the bond market, and my prediction, I called Lehman Brothers years ago, and I think the next bank to go is Credit Suisse, because the bond market is crashing. He explained recently that the bond market, which is bigger than the stock market, is the economy's biggest problem and will put the U.S. in serious trouble. Kiyosaki explained the U.S. dollar is losing its hegemony in the world right now, so they're going to print more and more and more of this, trying to keep this thing from sinking. Just hours after Kiyosaki's warning, Credit Suisse itself identified material weaknesses as the cost of insuring its bonds from defaulting reached the highest level. The investment bank admitted in its delayed annual report recently that it had not yet stemmed customer outflows. Credit Suisse, which has been hit by a series of scandals lately, claimed its customer outflows in the fourth quarter jumped to over $120 billion, putting it in breach of some liquidity buffers. The bank's share price fell more than 14% on Friday, March 17th, to a record low amid market turmoil triggered by the collapse of U.S. banks.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. The Israeli regime has been escalating tensions in the region over the past several months at an alarming rate. On average, more than one Palestinian has been killed per day by Israeli forces. This year, the regime continues with expanding settlements on occupied Palestinian land despite international outcries. And there seems to be no end to airstrikes in Syria, and even an Israeli official has implied the regime's claim over Jordanian territory. All these and more are happening while Tel Aviv is facing months of protests against the extreme far-right cabinet of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, which seeks to change the regime's judicial system. Why so much escalation outside while facing issues inside? That's what we'll try to find out in tonight's Spotlight with our guests. Researcher and political analyst Christopher Halali joining us from Verscher, Vermont. Also joining us on tonight's program, we have Professor of Political Science at Al-Azhar University, Mohammer Abu Saada, joining us from Gaza City.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Halali. Israel has conducted two major airstrikes on Syria's Aleppo International Airport in less than a month. Just as a reminder, the airport is the main port for entry of foreign aid to quake victims in Syria. Iran, for one, has strongly condemned Israel's attacks at the UN. How much of a threat does Israel's actions like these attacks pose to regional peace and stability?
It, of course, impacts the region tremendously. And Israel's aggression and the aggression of the regime of Tel Aviv is known throughout the region, especially in the past few years, as its escalations have increased against the Syrian Arab Republic. We must make mention, of course, that the relationship and diplomatic relations between the Zionist regime and between Syria are in a state of war, and they have been for many decades due to the occupation of the Golan Heights. So, of course, you know, Tel Aviv uses the pretext of quote-unquote Shia militias or Iranian-backed militias in Syria to continue to assault the Syrian people and the Syrian Arab Republic. Not only there, but throughout the region, it continues to destabilize its regional neighbors, and it continues to put tremendous pressure on the West to support it from in terms of illegally attacking its neighbors, and of course, a possible strike on Iran. So it is a great threat to the region.
Mohammed Abu Saad, the Iranian deputy ambassador to the United Nations, Zahra Ershadi, says the regime strikes violate international law by targeting the civilian infrastructure. She urges the Security Council to hold Israel accountable for its crimes. That, of course, as we know, has not happened. Tell us more about this lack of international action from bodies such as the United Nations, the EU, the OIC, the Arab League, most notably Arab governments, that has contributed to this status quo.
Many thanks for inviting me to be part of this program. Well, Israel has systematically violated international law and international standards many times, whether by attacking civilians in Syria or attacking the Palestinian on the occupied Palestinian territory in the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem. And we have witnessed many Israeli crimes against the Palestinians in the occupied Palestinian territory. And maybe during the program, I will have more time to document many of these cases where Israel has violated international law and international conventions. But going back directly to your question, why Israel has succeeded in escaping international accountability or international punishment against its attacks against civilians in Syria, in Lebanon, and in the occupied Palestinian territories. Unfortunately, the UN system has been very much controlled by the permanent members of the UN Security Council, in which the U.S. has very much used its veto power and provided impunity to Israel at the UN Security Council many times. The U.S. has used its veto power, for example, to protect Israel from any UN Security Council resolutions 42 times since 1967. Tens of times that the U.S. has provided immunity for Israel from international accountability. And it's not only the U.S. We also know that there are other countries and other members of the UN Security Council, like Britain, who has also used its veto power provide immunity for Israel from any international sanctions or any international condemnation. It's very rare when the UN Security Council or the international community has used its power to condemn Israel and condemn its practices against the Palestinians. And let me just give you a very vivid example of what we have been witnessing lately. Speeches by radical Israeli ministers like Itamar Ben-Gvir, who is the national security minister in Israel, and also Bezalel Smotrich, who is the minister of finance and also holding another position as minister within the ministry of the Israeli army. They have been speaking publicly against the Palestinians. And let me just remind you of what Smotrich has stated just less than a month ago, when he called for the wiping out of a Palestinian village because a Palestinian resistance fighter came out of that village and shot two Israeli settlers. And also just a week ago, Smotrich was speaking in Paris by showing a map of the so-called Greater Israel, which included historic Palestine and Jordan.
Right.
And unfortunately, we haven't really heard that international condemnation or international action against this Israeli ugly statement or Israeli appalling statement, which destabilizes peace and security in the region.
Sure. Back to Mr. Halali. Our guest in Gaza brought up the issue of Bezalel Smotrich. Jordanian lawmakers have called for the expulsion of the Israeli ambassador following the racist remarks by this far-right Israeli minister who recently denied the existence of Palestinians and the Palestinian people. The House of Representatives almost unanimously approved that motion. Could this serve, in your opinion, as a precedent for other regional countries and Arab countries to follow suit as well?
I think the dear professor is absolutely correct in his assessment. And I also think that in relation to your question, I would hope, and I think that everybody here would agree, that this would serve as a precedent to increase the pressure on the Israeli regime and to increase a lot of what is happening in terms of Israel's role. But I think ultimately one of the main things to recognize is that the tremendous power that it has internationally and in terms of international relations and diplomacy. And so there are a lot of regional partners and allies of Israel that have been forged through U.S. and Western support. So it's unlikely that some governments and regimes in the Arab world would move to this level that Jordan is now moving towards. Of course, it was personally attacked, and its country was denied its territorial integrity and its sovereignty due to Smotrich's remarks. But of course, we recognize that Israel is working very closely with the Moroccan regime, which is continuing its occupation of Western Sahara and its war against the Polisario Front. And so Israel is continuing to make overtures to Arab governments with the support of the West in order to firm its support in the Arab world. I hope that this move to expel the Israeli ambassador and to sever its diplomatic ties would increase in that regard. But it's not for sure. And, you know, the pressure on a lot of these governments is tremendous, especially when it's tied to international aid and international monetary system, which, of course, is dominated by the West.
Professor Abu Saada, staying on the topic, Smotrich's comments, if we look at them, weren't just directed at Palestinians. He also took a jab at Arab countries in the region as well. Maybe some of these Arab governments should think twice about normalizing ties with the Israelis, because these normalizations, in fact, will embolden Israel to continue with its racist and criminal behavior.
I completely agree with you, and that is definitely a very important issue to be raised up here. The speech by Smotrich in Paris did not only was not only directed against the Palestinians, in which he very much said that the Palestinian people is an invention, and it was invented, according to him, about 100 years ago, very much around the Balfour Declaration, which was given to the Jews in 1917. But also the statements by Smotrich also were directed toward Jordan, in which he basically, on the map that he showed during his speech, he included Jordan as a part of Israel, and that is a very flagrant violation of the peace agreement between Jordan and Israel, which was signed in October of 1994, almost 29 years ago, in which both Israel and Jordan established diplomatic relations with each other. And yes, I agree with you that around two and a half years ago, a number of Arab countries, UAE, Bahrain, Morocco, and Sudan, normalized their relations with the State of Israel. Now that these countries, they have to put up with these racist statements, not only from Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, but also that Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, has not put pressure on these ministers to make them back down or to make them apologize for these appalling statements, whether against the Palestinians or also Jordanian. And I think one thing that took place over the past week, that Jordan Ministry of Foreign Affairs called the Israeli ambassador in Amman, Jordan, to protest and to reprimand him for these racist statements and appalling statement by Smotrich against Jordan. Also, the Egyptian Ministry of Foreign Affairs rejected and condemned such statement by Smotrich and many other Israeli radicals. But I think it's about time that the Arab countries who normalized their relations with Israel lately rethink again of their normalization with Israel, because if the U.S. has decided not to extend an invitation to Netanyahu to visit the White House, and as I know that the visit by Prime Minister Netanyahu to London was not a very good one, I think it's about time that the Arab countries normalizing relations with Israel take a much more tougher stand against Israel and against its radical ministers who are speaking publicly against the Palestinians, Jordanians, and the Arabs in general.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Christopher Halali, the Israeli regime's forces and settlers have escalated their deadly acts of aggression against the Palestinians since around late December of 2022. That's when Benjamin Netanyahu staged a comeback as the regime's prime minister. Now, recently, the Knesset approved a bill that allows Israeli settlers to return to evacuated settlements north of the occupied West Bank. What are the Israelis achieving with this type of land grab policy? Apart from Judaization of Palestinian land, do you think that the Israelis are also deliberately trying to sabotage any prospects of a future Palestinian state?
There, at this point, the Israelis have no concept of a future Palestinian state. It's all but dead to them. And I think many scholars and academics and journalists have rightly noted that the two-state solution floated at Oslo and afterwards was a total sham and a cover for increased Israeli aggression and the hasbara, the propaganda of the Israeli state to justify its ongoing settlements and its ongoing, like you mentioned, Judaization of the Palestinian land. I think for us, we must recognize that this legalization and abrogation of a 2005 law that forced the evacuation of four settlements, and now this U-turn by the Netanyahu regime shows that it is not committed to peace. It's not committed to a two-state solution. It wants a one-state solution where Israeli citizens who are Jewish are at the top, according to the nationality law, and those that are Arab are at the bottom, and all other minorities. So I see ultimately here the rogue nature of the Israeli state, that it completely with discounts and rejects any notions of international law and international order and precedence, and its continuing expansion in clear violation of the United Nations and of international law shows that it is not committed to peace at all. It is committed to increasing its territory, illegally annexing territory that belongs to the Palestinians, and is, of course, part of historic Palestine. And it will continue to do this so long as nobody challenges it, or that so long as the aid keeps flowing from Washington and from its other allies. And I think that ultimately, unless that stops and unless Israel is confronted, it will continue this increased occupation and annexation until it takes all of historic Palestine and now increases its territory, possibly moving into Jordan. And I think that this is very dangerous escalation. but it's part of what the plan is for the Greater Israel Project, as many have spoken about over the past decades.
Professor Abu Saada, the occupied territories, as we know, have been rocked by protests for weeks over Netanyahu's controversial judicial reforms. That's, of course, in addition to the escalated violence against Palestinians. Now, if approved by Parliament, this new proposed bill would weaken the Supreme Court and grant the ruling coalition more powers in appointing judges. These reforms have also drawn condemnation from Tel Aviv's allies such as the United States and Germany. Given the nature of the new extreme hard right cabinet, what are they pursuing with these amendments?
That's definitely a very good issue here. Since the coming of this government, which is the fifth government led by Netanyahu as a prime minister, it came into power on December 29th of last year, 2022. So this government has been in office in about 3 months now. And the Israeli opposition has been protesting against this Israeli government for 11 weeks now. Israeli protesters in tens of thousands, whether in Tel Aviv and other Israeli cities that include Beersheba, Haifa, and other smaller areas, to protest this against the current right-wing government to overhaul the Israeli judicial system. And there is a very much an internal war between the current coalition and the Israeli opposition led by Yair Lapid and Benny Gantz. Just yesterday, the leader of the Israeli opposition, Yair Lapid, issued a statement saying that Prime Minister Netanyahu is lying with regard to internal negotiations with the opposition to try to come up with a solution to the current internal crisis in Israel. But it seems to me that there is a standoff between the current Israeli government and the Israeli opposition. Every one of them is holding a very tough and strong stand against the other. And it seems to me that Israel is drifting gradually into more instability. For example, the president of Israel, Itzhak Herzog, has stated about 2 weeks ago that Israel might find itself in the state of a civil war because of the internal clashes between the current supporters of the current coalition and the opposition. And also, the minister of the army, Yoav Gallant, has informed the prime minister that there is unhappiness among many Israeli members of the army because of these judicial reforms. It seems to me that no solution is on the table until this moment. Netanyahu is, with the support of his coalition members, who make 64 seats in the Israeli Knesset out of 120 seats, they are very much going forward with these judicial reforms, which is very much upsetting the Israeli opposition and making things intolerable for the Israeli opposition. I believe that even though the U.S. has